Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. It's been an especially violent year in the West Bank. More Palestinians are getting killed, and more are becoming militants.
They're growing up in a situation where they have no political representation on their side and no partner on the other side interested in talking with them.
Also today, calls from the UN for armed intervention in Haiti. Some Haitians are skeptical.
Since the 1990s, 1980s, we had, you know, many forms of UN intervention in Haiti, and look at Haiti right now.
I'm Marco Werman, plus a Sri Lankan novelist wins the Booker Prize for his writing about the afterlife.
We have this illusion that all the questions will be answered when we breathe our last, that you close your eyes, open them, and then suddenly it all makes sense. And it made more sense to me that you'll be absolutely more confused.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us this Tuesday. We begin in Haiti, where misery for people there is only getting worse. Cholera is spreading, clean water and food are in desperately short supply, and armed gangs that have much of the capital, Port-au-Prince, in their grip continue to blockade the main fuel terminal. This week, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for armed intervention.
In the present circumstances, we need an armed action to release the port and to allow for a humanitarian corridor to be established.
But the idea of sending foreign troops to Haiti is explosive. That's according to Widlaw Merancourt. He's the editor of the Haitian news outlet Aibo Post. He joins us from Port-au-Prince. Widlaw, give us a sense of what it's like to live in Haiti right now, at this moment.
Okay, at this moment, the country is in standstill since the 12th of September. Remember, this is when the most powerful gang leader in Haiti, Mr. Jimmy Cherizier, took the decision to block the access to Terminal Varreux, which is the place where 70% of the fuel that is distributed all over the country is stored.
And the latest moves to address these crises, the UN Security Council is debating whether an international force can help. The U.S. and Mexico are preparing a U.N. resolution to authorize an international mission. Is that idea popular among the Haitians that you know?
I mean, foreign intervention is a charged and explosive subject in Haiti. The past intervention of the UN in Haiti brings us the cholera epidemic. About 10,000 people died and more than 800,000 people were infected by the disease. Since the 1990s, 1980s, we had many forms of UN intervention in Haiti. And look at Haiti right now. But we sure need some, you know, help from the international community. But any help right now could be perceived as a help to this government, which people are protesting against.
Haiti's current prime minister, Ariel Henry, came to power after the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse last year. His killers still have not been found. How much legitimacy does the Ariel Henry administration have?
Well, you have to, you know, just look at the streets. Every time a protest is announced, you have thousands of people, you know, going into the streets to protest against Mr. Ariel Henry. Mr. Ariel Henry was picked 2 days before the assassination of the president to become prime minister, but he became actual prime minister because he had the support of international actors. But quickly, people realized that his name was implicated in the assassination. He fired a prosecutor who was investigating him for his alleged link to at least one of the assassins, alleged assassins.
So gangs, as we know, armed gangs, are at the root of the problem in Haiti and perhaps complicating any foreign intervention to unblock their control of the port where there is food and fuel is the accusation among some Haitian political activists that the government of Haiti is in cahoots with these armed gangs. Is there any evidence to back that up?
It's difficult to have proof, but these accusations have been swirling around, not only for Mr. Ariel Henry, but for different governments. What we do know for a fact is the Prime Minister, according to several media reports, but also according to a former prosecutor and a judge in the case, had linked and allegedly met with some of the folks that are accused in the assassination of the past president, Mr. Jovenel Moïse, last year. And we also have different reports that says the actual government negotiated and sometimes transferred money to the gangs.
This weekend, the U.S. and Canada sent armored vehicles and other supplies to Haiti's national police. What difference will that make? Will it help?
We need to go to the root cause of the problem. And one of the root causes of the problem is, of course, the historic inequality. Haiti is one of the most unequal countries in this region. But we also have to go against, and this is something that was discussed in the UN session yesterday, the fact that some business folks in Haiti are using the gangs as a way to threaten the government and to threaten people working in the administration and to, for instance, not pay customs as they should. We need also to fight against these masterminds, these business people and these political folks that are arming the gangs, giving them guns, and telling them what to do and where to block and which businesses to burn.
So the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said this week that any foreign intervention in Haiti would be limited and would be led by a country with deep experience in the region. She also said this about the role of the U.N. right now.
Haiti has come to us in a time of need. As Security Council members charged with maintaining international peace and security, it is our responsibility to come together to help restore peace and security for the people of Haiti.
She says that the UN has to step in. Widlaw, remind us, though, what are the main lessons from past interventions?
I think the main lessons from past intervention is whenever you come to a place and you discard the views and the opinions and the feelings, quite frankly, of local population, you are setting yourself up for failure. After the 2010 earthquake, for instance, hundreds of millions of dollars actually were delivered to Haiti, but there were no local accountability. Then in most cases, most of this money came back to the donors with fees and management fees and etc. So it is important to take into account the fact that many times in the past, when foreign actors want to do things in Haiti, they do not involve Haitians as they should. They do not take into account the failures of the past. And this is what people are trying to address now by saying, we don't want, a lot of people in Haiti right now do not want a foreign intervention. And if we want some help from the international community, here is how we think it would make a difference.
Widlaw Merancourt is the editor of the Haitian news outlet Ayibo Post. He joined us from Port-au-Prince to talk about the possibility of an armed international intervention in Haiti. Widlaw, thank you very much for speaking with us again.
Thank you very much.
In Ukraine, the Russian military attacks on civilian infrastructure continue. Today, energy facilities were destroyed, leaving part of the capital and other cities with no power and no water. Just 24 hours earlier, several people were killed in Kyiv and elsewhere by so-called kamikaze drones, also known as suicide drones. They're reportedly being supplied by Iran. The world's Shirin Jafari is here with more. Shirin, how have these drones changed the situation on the ground in Ukraine?
Well, these drones have been able to reach areas in Ukraine that Russian troops have not been able to reach in about 8 months of fighting. And they've really been causing panic among the people in these cities. Just have a listen to this sound from a video that was posted online. So in this video, you can see people are running around, they're trying to find shelter, and some of them stop to look up in the sky because they can see the drone right above their heads. And you can hear the drones as well, which is kind of really terrifying. And this seems to be Russia's goal here, to sow fear among civilians and to send a message that it can reach, you know, even central Kyiv, even if its ground troops couldn't. And Marco, until about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the front lines in Ukraine were more or less clear. But now these drones are making it feel like the front lines can be anywhere and everywhere.
Yeah, that is really scary. How big are these drones, Shiren? Give us a visual.
They look like a triangle, and there's something like 11 feet long and about 8 feet wide. They weigh around 400 pounds, and that's the drone part. They also have a missile part that they carry, and these are explosives, and, you know, this is what makes them really dangerous.
What do we know about why Russia is using these drones, and what do we know about speculation about where they get them from?
So in the last month or so, Russian troops have faced some serious setbacks on the battlefield. They've lost territory in the Donetsk, in Kharkiv, in the Kherson region. And then you had the major explosion of the bridge that connects the Crimea Peninsula with Russia. And some experts say that, you know, these attacks on civilian areas and the use of these drones, they want to send a message that Putin is still in control. As for where Russia gets these drones, experts have analyzed the photos and videos of the wreckage of these drones, and they say they are Shahed drones made in Iran.
So take that further. We know the Russian military is well equipped. They have missiles. Why would Russia need Iran to supply drones?
So Russia ran through its own supplies early in the war, and its weapons manufacturers can't really make them fast enough. Russia also doesn't have an advanced drones program. Iran, on the other hand, does. But I should point out that these drones, the Shahed 136, they're not really sophisticated. And I spoke about this with Peter Singer last week. He's an expert on drone warfare with the New America think tank. He said because these drones are so slow, some conventional defense technologies set up for high-speed jets or missiles, they can't really work against them. But there are some new technologies that can help.
In particular, it's using basically jamming, and it might be large-scale jamming devices. There's one that is being reportedly provided to Ukraine that is a kit that, you know, literally can fit on a Toyota truck.
So Ukraine has been destroying some of these drones, but the problem is that the Russians are sending them in swarms, meaning that, you know, they're sending more than one at a time. And sometimes they can get past these defense technologies. And Singer says that is where the problem is.
What has been the response from Ukraine to this Russian drone warfare?
So, of course, the Ukrainians are not happy about this. They have called out Iran for putting these drones in the hands of Russians. Today, Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, spoke about this.
Tehran несе повну відповідальність за руйнацію.
Kuleba is saying here that Tehran bears full responsibility for these drones and that, you know, these drones target civilians. And he said that's why he's asking President Zelensky to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. At the same time, the Ukrainians are asking the European Union to put sanctions on Iran for helping Russia, and they're reaching out to the Israelis for more air defense support.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
Despite the name, the World Series is still a North American event, but it's easy to argue that baseball in North America has become a truly international game. The opening day rosters back in April featured 275 foreign-born players from 21 different countries and territories. That accounted for nearly 30% of all major leaguers. Take the San Diego Padres, who face the Philadelphia Phillies this week, a trip to the World Series on the line. The Padres have players from Japan, the Dominican Republic, Cuba, Curacao, and South Korea, to name a few places. Their teammates are making an effort to learn a few phrases in each other's languages. Recently, when Padres third baseman Manny Machado cheered on shortstop Ha Sung Kim in Korean, the South Korean play-by-play announcers took notice. I love you, Machado had yelled from the dugout. The love of the game is being felt by the Padres, Phillies, and the Houston Astros, all in the playoffs. Tonight, fans in Cleveland and New York City face a go-big-or-go-home game to see which of their teams will join the other three. Just ahead, France goes on strike, with workers sending the message they are fed up with inflation and profiteering. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. It's the world. In France, thousands of rail workers, teachers, and hospital staff have walked off the job as a nationwide strike got underway today. It presents the biggest challenge for French President Emmanuel Macron since winning re-election earlier this year. Trade unions had called for a national day of action in response to soaring energy bills and rising inflation. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, is following the news. When a general strike is called in France, Orla, it can really throw daily life off balance. How disruptive has today's strike been?
Actually, not as disruptive as some expected and as some of the trade unions had obviously hoped. You're right in saying, you know, train workers, rail workers walked out. One in two trains in the southern part of the country were affected. But in Paris, for example, the metro continued to operate as normal. And data from the education ministry this afternoon also showed that less than 10% of teachers actually came out to strike. In many ways, Marco, the most disruption is still at the gas stations, because that strike by workers at France's oil refineries that we've been seeing now in its third week, more than a quarter of pumps at gas stations across the country are either partially or fully dry. That's what's affecting French families the most.
What was the issue with those oil refineries? Why'd they start in the first place?
Well, it's all about wages and inflation and cost of living. And they say that these energy giants have been, you know, raking in millions since the war started. So they say that it's time the workers felt some of those increases and received some of those profits.
So why did that spread to other sectors?
Well, a big part is all about wages. You know, electricity bills shooting up, inflation is at over 6%, which actually is among the lowest figures you see in the EU right now. I think in the UK it's around 11%, but still it's enough to cause pain among workers. But also, part of the reason people took to the streets is that the government's response to the oil refinery workers' strike has been a pretty hardline response. They forced some of the workers back to work. The government threatened some of those refinery workers with fines and criminal charges if they refused to work. And that measure did infuriate the unions, and that it did encourage some other workers to take to the streets. But also, the strike is all about politics, and it's all about increasing pressure on Macron's government. We saw a big march in Paris on Sunday against the rising cost of living, but that march was led by the leader of the hard left party, France Unbowed, Jean-Luc Mélenchon.
So we know the French public has seen strikes, large and small, over the years. What's the response been to this one? How much support does this work stoppage have?
It's pretty mixed, actually, and by all accounts, less than what we expect in France, because this is a country that knows how to strike. Its workers like to take the streets, as you know, and strikes tend to get a lot of widespread support. But there's one poll out this morning that showed that just a third of workers are prepared to strike over the coming weeks, and only 39% said that they supported today's action. And I spoke to French economist Nicolas Bouzou about this earlier, and he said part of the reason is that the French oil giant Total Energies, which employs so many of these oil refinery workers, it released details of the wages of those workers, and those wages appear to be better than what a lot of people expected.
It was quite surprising to notice that the wages are quite high. And I think French people are conscious of the fact that we are in a quite difficult situation with the war in Ukraine, with the shortage in gas, oil, and it will be catastrophic to have a general strike which lasts.
So as Bouzou is saying there, if the strikes go on much longer, people will actually find it harder, because already the oil refinery strikes have made things very difficult for a lot of families.
The World's Orla Barry is following the news of today's general strike in France. Orla, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Marco.
World leaders, from Pope Francis to President Biden, have been calling for reforms to the United Nations Security Council. That's in large part because of the ongoing war in Ukraine. But there have also been appeals to restructure this vital body of the UN coming from African leaders. From Nairobi, the world's Halima Gikandi has more.
When the United Nations was established in 1945, in the wake of World War II, a Security Council was created and charged with an enormous task, says Nigerian academic George Mbara.
This Security Council was laden with so much power and authority to ensure that there's global peace and security.
Britain, China, France, Russia, and the United States are permanent members, while 10 non-permanent members are elected for two-year terms. Of course, the world has changed a lot since 1945, and many argue the Security Council should change too. Michel Xavier Biang is the UN ambassador from Gabon, which is currently on the UN Security Council.
Nous voulons une réforme du Conseil de sécurité. Nous la voulons maintenant.
The time for reform is long overdue, Biang said earlier this month. African countries should have permanent seats on the council. And he isn't the only one saying this. Kenya's new president, William Ruto, called on the council to be more representative when he addressed the UN last month. Kenya is also finishing up a two-year term on the Security Council.
The relevance, legitimacy, and moral authority of the United Nations will forever remain deficient, undermined by the absence of comprehensive reforms of the United Nations Security Council.
African countries have been calling for reforms at the UN Security Council for years. Back in 2005, they reached a common position called the Uzulwini Consensus. It said African countries should be given permanent representation. Here's George Mbara again.
They said we must get two permanent seats on the enlarged or reformed council and five non-permanent seats. And they hinged this argument on Africa's population.
Mbara says African leaders also point out that much of the Security Council's agenda is directly related to Africa. But under this plan, which two African countries would get permanent seats on the Security Council? Mbara says Nigeria, South Africa, and Egypt have all pitched themselves.
So these are the three major contenders for this position. However, Africa is demanding for two permanent representatives, and there are three countries contesting for these positions. So who is going to get it, and what are their criteria? What are they bringing to the table?
Nigeria is the most populous country in Africa. South Africa has a strong economy, while Egypt is connected to the Arab world. But George Mbara says domestic factors should be considered too.
How stable are their local economies? How stable is their civil populace? Do they have the support of their people? And thirdly, what is their role and in their regional politics?
It's not just African leaders talking about making big changes at the UN Security Council. Here's Joe Biden addressing the UN General Assembly last month.
The United States supports increasing the number of both permanent and non-permanent representatives of the Council. This includes permanent seats for those nations we've long supported, and permanent seats for countries in Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean.
But Elliot Abrams of the Council on Foreign Relations is skeptical. He says making the Security Council larger is a bad idea.
You are going to make it harder, almost certainly, to do business. The larger the group becomes, the more difficult it is, the more unwieldy it is to get votes and to get things done.
Abrams tells me that reforming the council might sound good until you start looking at the details.
I do not think the work of the Security Council, particularly when it comes to democracy and human rights issues, would be advanced by putting a government such as that of Egypt on the Security Council.
Still, Abrams says that despite Biden's recent statement, reforming the UN Security Council is unlikely to happen anytime soon. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
In Russia, journalists have been fleeing their country and fast.
In 2 o'clock, I knew that I have to leave. And in 4 or 5 o'clock, I was driving to the airport. It was very, very quick.
Now, many like her are in neighboring Latvia, beaming news back to Russia and creating a hub of resistance. That story coming up this half hour on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Central America, tens of thousands of people are recovering from Hurricane Julia. It made landfall a little over a week ago and exposed many communities, once again, to extreme flooding. From the city of San Pedro Sula in Honduras, Anna Catherine Brigida reports on how this latest hurricane could lead many people to migrate north.
Hector Suazo Maldonado is what they call a fletero in Honduras. This means he works as a driver helping people transport furniture and other large items. Hurricane season is good for business.
Yo colocaba las camas hacia
I would arriba, put the beds up top, si if possible too, he tells me. Then here, he points to the bed of the truck, he would put the fridge, stove, and other appliances. As the rain poured down on San Pedro Sula 2 weekends ago, Maldonado says the calls also started flooding in. There was a woman who told me urgently to come get her out because she needed it, he tells me. Given her emotional state, she said that I had to get her out with urgency. but I told her that I had another client and I had to get that other client out. They weren't wrong to be anxious. Just 2 years ago, Hurricanes Eta and Iota caused extreme flooding, filling some houses with water up to the roofs. People lost everything. They weren't taking chances this time. On the Tuesday after Julia made landfall, a school in San Pedro Sula was full of kids, though they weren't studying. Dozens of families were staying there, displaced by the hurricane. Kids kicked a soccer ball in a covered courtyard. When I arrived, entire families had been sleeping in the classrooms for 2 days. They came with everything, fridges and mattresses. 22-year-old Christian Ramos sat outside a classroom next to his motorcycle and washing machine. When you're poor, you can't just leave your things there to be destroyed, he says, because it's difficult to buy them again. Ramos works in metal welding, but he barely makes more than minimum wage. It's not enough to support his wife and their 4-year-old. What they own now was bought secondhand after Eta and Iota, but it was nearly impossible to start over. After the 2020 hurricanes, Ramos felt there was nothing left to do but look for better opportunities outside Honduras. He told his wife he was going to try his luck at migrating, and he left. But he didn't make it. In the year after those storms, more than 300,000 Hondurans were caught crossing the U.S.-Mexico border by Border Patrol agents. This was a drastic increase of more than 20% compared to pre-pandemic crossings. Now, Hondurans like Ramos are thinking of leaving again. Let's go again and try our luck once more, a friend keeps telling him. Cesar Ramos works closely with migrants through the Mennonite Social Action Commission. He says this hurricane season could be another decisive one for migration. When people don't find alternatives, they see the necessity to have to migrate from the country in search of better life conditions, he says. Because in Honduras, we know that the fact that many families are in a vulnerable situation has become a structural problem, and it has to do with the abandonment on the part of the state. After Eta and Iota, the dams that protected communities from flooding broke. They still haven't been fixed. The Disaster Prevention Agency didn't respond to an interview request, but officials have told local media they've invested more than $5 million in hurricane prevention. A new government took office this year, and the president has promised to invest more. Still, people feel forgotten by the politicians, and they feel hopeless. Perfecta Solis was housed at the school shelter last week. Who is helping the poor people? Who is helping the people who brought them to power? No one helps, she said. When I left the shelter on Tuesday, people told me they were being kicked out by government officials. They didn't want to leave because they thought it wasn't safe to go home. So I went back 2 days later to see what happened. There's no one here anymore. The worker who's cleaning up says everyone left yesterday. It's a sunny day, no more rain. It's quiet now, no more kids running around playing. Hopefully, they won't be back soon if there's another storm. For The World, I'm Anna Catherine Brigida in San Pedro Sula, Honduras.
For a region that is accustomed to violence, 2022 has been especially brutal in the occupied West Bank. The number of Palestinians killed has eclipsed 100. That puts this year on track to be the deadliest there since 2015. It's happening in large part because the Israeli military has increased the number of raids on Palestinian towns to try and root out a growing number of militants. To dig deeper into all of this, we reached out to Meirav Zonzain in Tel Aviv. She's a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. Meirav, why have so many Palestinians been killed in the West Bank this year? Is it simply a byproduct of more raids by the Israeli military, or are there other factors?
Yeah, it is mostly a byproduct of that, but I would say it's kind of reflecting the fact that Israelis, as far as trying to keep things quiet in the West Bank, are having a hard time, and the kind of de facto policy that has taken shape over the last few years, especially in the last few months, is a kind of shoot as much as we can possibly to defend ourselves and not, you know, get any soldiers hurt. And in many, many cases, people are killed.
There are also Israeli checkpoints where it seems many Palestinians have also been killed. I mean, these checkpoints are, it seems, a real hassle when many Palestinians encounter several of them each day on their commutes. What's happening at those checkpoints that leads to violence?
Well, there are certain cases in which Palestinians are trying to retaliate in violence or attack Israelis, whether soldiers and at certain times also civilians. And so they're going to these checkpoints, and that's where they're targeting Israelis. The issue with checkpoints is that the Israeli army can set up a checkpoint at any given time, at any given moment, in any given place. So at any given moment, a Palestinian will come up to a checkpoint. And if he, you know, raises any kind of threat or hand, chances are he'll be shot at.
What is it like for ordinary, you know, non-militant Palestinians to be navigating life in the West Bank, avoiding the Israeli military and violent settlers? I mean, how hard is that?
Yeah, Palestinian daily life has become in many places insufferable. I mean, when we hear about violence in the West Bank, it's usually because there's been a few attacks by Palestinians on Israelis. But on a daily level, there is extreme amounts of systematic violence on regular Palestinians across the West Bank, whether it's, you know, restrictions on the freedom of movement, on their ability to enter Israel to work, on their ability to access their agricultural lands. They suffer from various aspects of vandalism and settler violence.
What does the Israeli government say its rationale is for these raids in the West Bank?
The rationale for Israel is, of course, security, and Israel wants to protect its citizens. I think what we're seeing is a reflection of Israel's inability, considering that it continues to occupy Palestinian territories, to be able to keep Israelis safe all of the time. And oftentimes it will create these raids and incursions in which Palestinians will be shot and killed in order to protect Israelis.
So why has there been a growth in Palestinian militancy in the West Bank?
Palestinians don't have an organized leadership. And the Palestinians that are currently organizing and arming themselves have grown up in the early 2000s. They don't remember the suffering backlash that Palestinians that were involved in the Second Intifada had to suffer. And all they basically have is a vacuum of authority on the Palestinian side, continued Israeli occupation and, you know, entrenching brutal military occupation. And so they are completely without any kind of political horizon, very little economic horizon. And so they have, you know, nothing else to do except to try and resist in some way. So we're seeing an uptick of that.
I mean, in the past years, Palestinians could at least count on the Palestinian Authority to play a diplomatic role and call for Israeli accountability. Where is the PA in all of this turmoil?
Well, the PA has long lost its legitimacy. The diplomacy has, you know, been empty words for quite a long time. And the PA security forces are less and less able to contain what Israel has called on them to do, which is to contain Palestinian militants. So at this point, Palestinian militants are acting completely on their own without any organized fashion. They're rising up, and the PA has little that it can do about it.
Merav, how much have Jewish settlers played a role in the increasing violence? I mean, is there a connection to the steady growth of settlements and settler demands for security?
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing in recent days isn't even a matter of settlement expansion. It's a matter of settlers. And what I mean by settlers are Israelis who live in the occupied West Bank, who are also in some ways creating these pseudo-armed militias. They're going out. Some of them are settlers. Some of them are soldiers in civilian clothing at the time. They're armed. They're going out. And if they feel that they are threatened, or even if they're not, they're getting out of their cars and they're shooting at Palestinian homes. They're shooting at Palestinians. They are threatening Palestinians. In different places in the West Bank, they're vandalizing olive trees. I mean, some of this settler violence we've seen over many years, but now we're seeing it become more and more incidents of armed settlers. And the IDF is often present and doesn't really do anything to stop it.
Where do you think this level of violence is headed?
It's headed nowhere good. There's no U.S. pressure to hold Israel accountable or to encourage the Palestinians to renew themselves politically through elections. The biggest danger here is that there's just nothing that will get us out of this loop of violence.
Merav Zonzion is a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. She joined us from Tel Aviv. Thank you for your time, Merav.
Thanks so much.
In Russia, under President Vladimir Putin, independent journalism has been all but silenced. It started with the Russian annexation of Crimea 8 years ago and new laws criminalizing free speech. That sent many Russian reporters into exile. Now with the war in Ukraine, even more are fleeing. Dozens of journalists have now set up shop next door in Latvia. Jerry Haddon reports from Latvia's capital, Riga, on how they got there and the stories they're sending back home.
Russian reporter Valeria Ratnikova hurries into a small recording booth and turns on her mic. She's on deadline. It's late in the day here in Riga, but Ratnikova's just gotten a video on Telegram, the encrypted messaging app. It's from a young Russian soldier. In the video, a wide-eyed 20-year-old who's just been drafted is telling Ratnikova that he's afraid he's not yet ready to fight.
Their commanders didn't give them all the things which they should took to the war, and also they didn't have any training. And after 6 days living in the forest, in some camp, they were said that they should go to Ukraine.
This is the kind of story Ratnikova says journalists can't cover back in Russia, a story critical of the government, questioning the war. She knows because she herself had to flee Moscow.
I left Russia in the night between 1st and 2nd of March.
After being awoken by a phone call, she says, it was her editor at Doge TV with a message, get out.
She said, I think it's too dangerous for you, and yes, you should do this.
Word was the station, called TV Rain in English, had run afoul of Russian censors. It had called the war in Ukraine a war. Arrests might be imminent. Ratnikova packed a bag.
In 2 o'clock, I knew that I have to leave, and in 4 or 5 o'clock, I was driving to the airport. So it was very, very quickly and painful.
As we're chatting, Ratnikova's story on the young soldier hits the internet. She's still filing for TV Rain, along with about 40 colleagues from Moscow who made it here to Riga. They produce for Rain's YouTube channel. That's how they reach viewers in Russia. TV Rain is one of a handful of independent Russian news outlets that have managed to rebuild outside Russia's borders. Almost all of their coverage is about the war. Across town in a small cafe, Anton Lysenkov holds a virtual news meeting for a different outlet. On his screen are correspondents in Georgia, Armenia, and in Russia itself. Exact location undisclosed.
I am the editor-in-chief of the Spectre Press online magazine. I think about 70% of our audience is still in Russia.
Lysenkov's been in Riga longer than reporter Ratnikova. He was a correspondent here in 2014 when Russia invaded Crimea and Putin began cracking down on the media. He decided to stay in Latvia. On today's agenda, covering the Ukrainian refugees crossing from Russia into Latvia, Russian authorities are scrutinizing them more than usual.
We haven't got a very clear understanding, unfortunately. We have witnesses that the Russian special forces started a more in-depth interrogations.
To get to the bottom of it, Lysenkov sends reporter Lev Kadik to Latvia's border with Russia. It's as close as they can get as they try to confirm what Russia's up to.
If you are a reporter, you have to see the picture by your eyes, right? And report what you see. We can see it from this side of the border only.
Kadik mills about interviewing refugees who've just gone through the Russian interrogations. Up until September, Russians could cross into Latvia too. Then they were barred, which means Latvia's Russian exile press corps isn't likely to grow. The reporters here say broadcasting into Russia can sometimes feel a bit like yelling echo in a flatlands. No response, no feedback from their own audiences. But once in a while, some brave listener pipes up, like this man who sent this audio message to reporter Valeria Ratnikova about why he's tuning in.
Well, it makes me feel good, of course, because I wanna be involved.
Maxim Gongalsky is somewhere in Russia.
I wanna know what's going on in Russia and in Ukraine, and I don't want to be exposed to propaganda.
For Ratnikova, the message offers some solace. She says she's thrown herself into her work in Latvia to keep Russians better informed, but also to forget the pain of leaving home. For The World, I'm Cherry Haddon, Riga, Latvia.
Iranian rock climber Elnaz Rakavi grabbed international attention in Seoul, South Korea on Sunday after competing in the Asia Championship finals there without a hijab, her ponytail hanging freely. People took notice largely because of the protests in Iran against laws that require women to wear a headscarf. But now, 2 days later, there are fears for the climber's safety. The Iranian embassy in Seoul says Rekabi flew back home this morning. The BBC reports that Iranian officials had seized her mobile phone and passport. A post on Rekabi's Instagram account says that not wearing the hijab was, quote, unintentional. The Iranian government routinely pressured citizens to give what human rights groups say amounts to forced confessions. Meanwhile, in Tehran, widespread anti-government protests continue. Next time on The World, we'll have the story of what it's like right now to be a woman protesting on the streets of Tehran. Join us for that tomorrow. In northern Turkey, an explosion in a state-owned coal mine killed 41 people last Friday. Rescue teams worked through the weekend to search for survivors and bring an underground fire under control. Mine safety is an ongoing problem in Turkey. It has one of the highest rates of mining-related deaths in Europe. As the world's Duri Biskaran reports from Istanbul, labor rights groups are again calling for change.
For 18 excruciating hours, rescue teams desperately searched for survivors in the Amasra coal mine. It's run by a state-owned company in the green hills of Bartın, overlooking the Black Sea. The explosion occurred about 1,000 feet below the surface. In short comments to the press, Turkish Energy Minister Fatih Donmez attributed it to a fire damp, or an underground buildup of flammable gases like methane. As sirens blared in the background, he urged onlookers to wait for the results of investigations. But grieving families had already begun to search for answers. It wasn't an accident, said one widow. My husband was murdered. Buse Bulut told the independent Turkish news channel Medyascope that her husband, Mehmet Bulut, had told her about smelling gas for several days before the incident. They were sending them inside without measuring the gas, she says. And they were supposed to install ventilation shafts 3 months ago, but she says they never did. Mehmet Bulut was 30 years old and the father of an 11-month-old baby. When Arzu Çerkezoğlu, leader of one of the largest trade unions in Turkey, heard the news, her first feeling was not again.
Soma'dan Ermeni'ye, işte Balıkesir'den.
First, there was Soma, she says, the 2012 mining explosion that killed 301 workers in western Turkey. Then there was Ermenek, a mine that flooded and killed 18 miners 6 months later. Then a collapse in Balıkesir, which killed one. And in 2016, a copper mine collapse killed 16 miners in Şirvan, a village in the southeast. Once again, people will say this is the destiny of the workers, Çerkezoğlu says. But she wants to see stronger worker safety laws, independent inspections, and internal audits to prevent these explosions from happening ever again. Until then, companies see the lives of workers as nothing more than a tool, she says. The challenge is that Turkey's state-owned mines face few repercussions when there's a disaster, and critics are quickly silenced. Over the weekend, the Turkish government opened investigations into social media users who allegedly shared provocative content about the Amasra mine explosion. And a law, newly passed by Turkey's parliament, will soon increase the penalty for spreading so-called misinformation to up to 3 years in jail.
Böylece 41 olmuş oldu.
Turkish public officials, including the president, spent the weekend visiting funerals of the victims and survivors in a hospital in Istanbul. Local prosecutors have launched a criminal investigation into the case. The mine has stopped operations and is being treated as a crime scene. Despite these actions, workers' rights groups fear they won't see major reforms anytime soon. For The World, I'm Duri Biskaran in Istanbul.
The Booker Prize is given each year to the best novel written in English and published in the UK or Ireland. This year's prize went to a writer from Sri Lanka, Shehan Karunateleke, for his novel The Seven Moons of Mali Almeida. The novel is set during Sri Lanka's civil war in the 1980s. The protagonist is a war photographer who wakes up dead and wants to figure out who murdered him. Dinidu Karunayake is Sri Lankan. He teaches English at Elon University in North Carolina. Dinidu, as an English prof, what was your reaction when you heard the news that a countryman of yours, Shehan Karunateleke, is this year's Booker Prize winner?
I was overjoyed to hear that. As an academic, as a post-colonial scholar, I teach Asian American literature. But I think it is larger than that. As a Sri Lankan living in the United States, it's a time of dreaming. We are very much connected to what's happening in our home country. So this is such a piece of promising news at a time of so many hopes. And it's also very fitting that Shyam Kalnath Tilaka has set his story in a dream world, in a cosmology of fantastic elements. And I think we are dreaming and we are dreaming with him.
Describe Karuna Tilaka's style as a writer.
He came to prominence in 2010 with his first novel, Chinaman, The Legend of Pradeep Mathew. And he blends humor, comedy, and satire into his writing. And I think one of the things that characterizes his writing is his ability to infuse sort of magic realist elements into satire. And I think that comes a lot in the latest novel.
So one of the conceits of the novel, The Seven Moons of Mala Ameda, is that in the afterlife, the protagonist, the dead war photographer, finds himself not in heaven, but in a kind of bureaucratic hell, the chaotic visa office in Colombo, the Sri Lankan capital. Here's Shehan Karunatilake talking about that.
We have this illusion that all the questions will be answered when we breathe our last, that you close your eyes, open them, and then suddenly it all makes sense. And it made more sense to me that you'll be absolutely more confused when you wake up. You're not sure why you're there and you've got memories of your past. And maybe that is a plausible explanation for why Sri Lanka seems to go from tragedy to tragedy, that there are all these restless spirits and ghosts wandering around, confused, not sure what they're supposed to do, and they amuse themselves by whispering bad ideas into people's ears.
That clip of the writer, that's from the Booker Prize website. Let me ask you, Dinidu, do Sri Lankans feel like their country is going from one crisis to another?
It's much more complicated than that. I mean, when you think about the current situation of Sri Lanka, it has a historical trajectory which goes all the way back to European colonialism. So I think it might be unfair to simply think about the current political crisis as existing in a vacuum. And to follow what Shehan mentioned in his clip, there are other writers who are using the same conceit, the afterlives of colonialism, which keep haunting the current trajectories of Sri Lankans living in the country.
Yeah, so in that post-colonial context, I'm curious to know what you think. How significant is it that the Booker Prize went to Shehan Karunatilake?
There's a resurgence of Sri Lankan writers on Sri Lanka and its post-colonial past, and also how Sri Lankan authors find new means to make sense of the new realities. And sometimes what we understand as reality cannot be encapsulated in the language that is available to us. They are envisioned in different modes of realism. And I think this novel is a quintessential example for that kind of mode. The Booker Prize definitely shifts the attention to what Sri Lanka has to offer, other than the crisis that it is going through right now.
Dinidu Karunanayake is Sri Lankan and teaches in the English department at Elon University in North Carolina. Dinidu, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong, and thank you for listening.